finally do get your PhD to be able to feel like you're glorious and wonderful and you can conquer the world. And that usually lasts from about, at least when you're on the semester system, from about the middle of August until about the middle of May. And then humility sets in. Humility sets in the ways that, as most of you know, from the universities, if you've ever been in contact with universities, that summer funding is the kind of thing that sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not, and usually not. And oftentimes professors have to go out and find some work for the summer in order to tide them over for the 3 months when they have nothing to do. This happened to a colleague of mine recently when he went to the chairman and said, hey, I'd like to be able to teach this summer. And the chairman said, well, we'd really like to have you teach this summer. The only real problem is that we don't have the money, so I'm afraid there's just nothing you can do. You're going to have to go out and find another job. So the professor said, well, okay, I don't know really what I'm going to do, but he decided to drop down to the employment office and see if he could find a job for the summer. So he went down and saw the employment counselor, and he went up and he said, listen, he said, I'm a full professor, and I don't have any teaching for the summer, and I really need a summer job, and I was wondering, you know, what you might have down on your sheet. And he said, I'm really very intelligent and very bright and very adaptable, and I can probably do most anything you have down there. So the guy goes, oh, well, let me see on the sheet. We have a thing here for a bricklayer. Said, bricklayers make good money. He goes, think you want to go lay bricks for the summer? And he goes, well, to be honest with you, I don't know much about that bricklaying stuff, but I really am very intelligent and very adaptable. I could probably do most anything else you have. So the guy looks down and says, this says, well. So they got a temporary opening here for a new account for public relations. He goes, think you can do that public relations stuff? And he goes, well, Scott, I don't know. I said, I don't know much about that public relations stuff, but really, I'm very bright and very intelligent and very adaptable. I could probably do most anything that you have. Well, this went on for an hour and a half. And finally, he gets down to the bottom of the sheet, and he says, well, he goes, I don't know. The counselor says to him, he says, I do have an opening here. He said, well, let me put it to you this way. He said, as you know, he said, one of the things that we have in Albuquerque that's very famous, he says, is the Rio Grande Zoo. And of course, when summertime hits, you know, and just as summer recess comes, they like to take all the elementary school kids out to the zoo. And one of their favorite attractions is the chimpanzees. So the problem is that our chimpanzee died last week. And so what I'm wondering if you'd be willing to do is to, you know, put on a chimpanzee suit and just kind of, you know, grunt and groan in front of a group of kids, you know, and just kind of dance around and show them a good time and entertain them. And the professor sat back from him and said, yeah, because I've had some experience doing that. He said, I think I'd be able to fit very well. So he said, it pays minimum wage. And the guy said, okay, I'll take it. You know, so he puts on his chimpanzee suit, goes down to the Rio Grande Zoo, and he starts jumping around in the cage. And of course, as you also heard from this morning's lecture, and what you know from positive reinforcement, the kids started really liking it. And the more they started clambering around the bars and applauding, the professor started swinging more vigorously on the bars and jumping up and down. Well, he got a little too carried away. And he just swung so far that he went over the cage and landed in the lion's den. Well, landing in the lion's den, the lion just kind of looked up at him, you know, and he kind of looks at this lion. He starts backing up a little bit, and the lion starts loping over, and he backs up, and the lion starts loping over. Finally, backs him into a corner. Finally, the professor decides with his lion still coming, he's had a little bit too much of this monkey business. He starts screaming, going, help, help, he goes, I'm not really a chimpanzee. He goes, I'm a man, I'm a man. At which point, the lion just jumped on him and says, shut up, you damn fool. You think you're the only college professor who can't get a summer job? Now, what does that have to do with communication? It does, but we won't be able to get that far today. In starting today's session, there's just a couple things I want to go over. I was also told that cocktails are supposed to be served at about, in about 45 minutes. I'm going to cut myself a little short because I don't want to miss out on that, even if you do. But there's a couple things I would like to talk about as far as just very basic problems and assumptions that we make about communication, which tend to give us some problems, okay? Communication is kind of as a starting point, is something that we do day in and day out, and something which obviously all of you do because of the field that you're in. The problem is that we do it so often that we take it for granted. We don't really think about those things that we're doing it. And because it's just kind of like a natural second sense for us, what we end up doing is making a lot of very basic mistakes that the things I'm going to be talking about today are not going to be earth-shattering. But they're going to be the kinds of things, if you sit back and reflect on them, you're going to find them to be true, and you're going to find them to being some of the biggest barriers to dealing effectively when you communicate with people. There are three basic assumptions. It's nice when you can categorize things in just three little things. So let's start with the basic three. The first one has to do with why we communicate. And if you ever really sat down and asked yourself, why do I communicate, you may have to think about it for a while to really come up with some answers. The assumption that we make, which is the erroneous assumption, is that we communicate to create messages. All right, obviously, I'm going to tell you that's not why we communicate. But if you think about it and think about how you do your jobs, and especially in mine, I often find myself falling into this trap of creating messages. If I can sit down and I can crank out 5 letters in a day, and I can send out 43 memos, and I can write 12 pages in a book, I feel like I've done a lot. And I feel like I've been very successful and very effective. On the other hand, if I spend 4 hours in the afternoon talking to a student, I somehow feel like I've wasted the entire day. Okay, has any of you ever gotten that feeling? If you didn't send out a lot of stuff, you don't feel like you've communicated very well, much of anything, kind of wasted the day? Change it around for a minute. All right, I'm going to propose that the reason why you communicate is to affect someone's behavior. You want them to do something. You want them to do something for you. Okay, if you do that, it may be that all of those letters I sent out and all of those memos and all of those things that I read in the book may have no impact on anybody. And if they don't have any impact on anybody, then I haven't been very effective. On the other hand, if I keep it somewhere in the back of the mind that the only reason why I'm communicating is to affect someone's behavior, whether I want them just to listen, whether I want them to respond to me, whether I want them to understand me, whatever the case may be, I want to affect another person. I want to have some impact on them. All right? That is the real reason why you communicate. You want to be able to get something accomplished. All right? Pretty mundane. We can skip that one. All right? The second one becomes a little more interesting, right? And that one has to do with where the meanings of words lie. Okay? If anyone was ever to ask you what the meaning of a word is, what do they tell you? Look it up in the dictionary. All right? And because we do that so often, we just go and look things up in the dictionary, and that's what tells us what the word means. But if you think about it, the meanings of words aren't in the words. They never are, and they never will be. The meanings of words are in people. The erroneous assumption being that the meanings of words are in words, and the correct assumption, if you will, is that the meanings of words are in people. Now, that doesn't sound very earth-shattering. You say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But think of how many times you forget that. How many times have you heard from your boss, or how many times have you gone to someone who's below you, and you told them to do something, and they didn't do it? And your response is, I don't understand why they didn't. I told them to do it. I don't understand why they didn't understand me. I explained it clear as day. I used all the right words. When you write a message, you want to make sure you use all the right words, because the words have the meaning. Well, the words don't have the meanings. They aren't there. What you're doing with that assumption is you're falling into the trap of what we call the bucket theory of communication, or the bucket theory of meaning. And what that means is I have all these meanings in these words, and I throw them in a bucket, and I carry them across the room, and I dump them in their heads. Okay? And it gets there. But it doesn't work that way. The meanings obviously have to be in with the people. A typical example of just a terrible case, but things like this happen, maybe not on this scale all the time. But there was a company back in Michigan where they had a very large account that was something to the tune of something like $80,000, which was a reasonable size account for one job. And they were getting a little late on getting this thing out. And they had a call in, and there were a number of things that happened with personality problems with secretaries and everything else between the two companies. They hated each other, but that's neither here nor there. The biggest problem was one that they decided they needed the job out like the next day by 5 o'clock. So it became a rush job. And once it finally got to the message that somebody decided, yes, it is really a rush job, they sent a message down to the dispatcher to make sure that they send it out rush, thinking that that would do it. All right? But what did the dispatcher do? You're not talking about the shipping clerk. He said, send it out rush. What the hell does rush mean? Last time I sent something out rush, I sent it out, you know, like courier freight, which cost, you know, a couple hundred dollars to have somebody pick it up from the plane and take it over to this other place, and I really got chewed out for that. So I'm obviously not supposed to send it out that way. Rush must mean that I just send it out first class mail, or first class shipment, or REA Express. So that's the way he sent it out. It got there 3 days later. They lost the account, lost a bundle of money. All because of a simple word, rush. What does rush mean? What does freedom mean? What does religion mean? What do all those things mean? Okay. Interesting story when you even talk about words. The English language is kind of strange because many words have dual meanings. As a professor of mine once found out, because a student of his when I was at Michigan State asked to borrow a quarter for a can of pop. And he lent him the quarter and he said, as long as you promise to give it back. He said, okay, fine. Well, 2 weeks had passed and the quarter hadn't come back. The professor decided to start giving him a hard time. He said, listen, buddy, so I lent you a quarter on good faith. said, if you don't get that quarter back to me soon, he goes, I'm going to start charging you interest. Student says, yeah, sure. Well, about 2 weeks later, professor was sitting down. He was writing a paper on his desk, and student kind of strolled in the office, reached into his pocket, pulled out a quarter, flipped it on his desk, and proceeded to walk out. Professor looked up, and as he was walking out the door, I said, wait a minute. He goes, where's the interest? Student said, in your class. The other problems with dual meanings in our words was something that Father Murphy once found out, too. Father Murphy, for those of you who don't know, was a priest who was in a very poor parish and decided that he needed to raise some money for the parish, but really didn't know how to go about doing it. So I went and talked to a PR man. I said, listen, what you ought to do in order to raise money is to race horses. Horses are where it's at. You can make a lot of money racing horses. The priest thought about it for a minute, thought it was a pretty good idea, and went out to buy a racehorse. Immediately found out he didn't have enough money to buy a racehorse. So he bought a donkey. Now, he trained his donkey for about a month, figured it was ready for the races, took the donkey and entered it in the races. The donkey did pretty good. First time the donkey went out, came in third place. Well, the papers got a hold of that one. Next day, the paper said, Father Murphy's ass shows. Well, Father Murphy, did not being too disturbed by that, went and took the donkey and entered it in the race the next day. This time, the donkey came in first place. He made a lot of money. Papers got a hold of that one, too. Said Father Murphy's ass out in front. Well, the next day, Father Murphy entered the donkey again, and this time the donkey didn't do as well, only came in second place. And the papers the next day said Father Murphy's ass back in place. Well, mind you, none of this was going unnoticed. I mean, the bishop was getting a little upset about the whole thing. So the bishop called up Father Murphy and said, hey, Father Murphy, because you've been reading the headlines lately? He goes, you stop racing that donkey. Father Murphy said, well, okay, yeah, I guess it has been kind of bad on the church. So the next day the papers got a hold of that. So the bishop scratches Father Murphy's ass. Well, the bishop became incensed at this point and said, Father Murphy, goes, you get rid of that donkey. Father Murphy had come rather attached to the donkey, didn't want to really sell it, so he gave it to Sister Agatha as a pet. Next day, the paper said, Father Murphy gives his ass to Sister Agatha. Well, the bishop now was just totally upset and said, Sister Agatha, get rid of the donkey, and Sister Agatha sold the donkey for $10. And the next day, the paper said, Sister Agatha peddles her ass for $10. And the bishop was buried 10 days later. So as you can see, the only reason why you laugh is because you all have a perverse mind and the meanings aren't really in words. We're just talking about donkeys. There's no problem there. Obviously, the meanings are not in the words themselves. You have to be very careful about what it is you say and make sure that what you're saying is understood by your receiver. And that becomes a very important point. And I'm going to tell you how to correct all these problems in a short period of time. Third assumptive barrier. We'll get to that and then we'll talk about ways of alleviating it. Third assumptive barrier is the kind of objective reality assumption. That we assume that there is a reality out there which everybody can see and everybody understands. The problem with it is that, I don't want to go into the philosophies of it, but there is no objective reality out there. It's a subjective reality. I mean, I can sit down and say, yes, this is a microphone, this is a podium, I'm wearing a blue suit, and we can all say, yeah, you know, he's doing that. But the podium, if you will, doesn't look the same to everybody. The microphone does not look the same to everybody. My suit does not look the same to everybody. My beard obviously doesn't look the same. Earlier in the day, I was going to be called a kooky weirdo. All right, now you got two of them in one morning. How are you going to deal with all of that? All right, somebody sooner or later is going to come along who's going to be clean shaven. You can all relax.
No.
The next one.
Well, the next one's got a beard too. We often said we were going to take over from the inside. But things will look differently to different people. The podium may look different for the only reason that you're sitting in different spaces and you're looking at it from different angles. If you will, it's a different podium. But even if you aren't dealing with the concrete things, the objective reality kind of is not there. We often assume, which is our greatest mistake, especially when we're giving messages to other people, that our receiver is approaching it with the same motivation as the sender of the message. If you get really excited about it, and how many times has it happened to you? You've had this great idea, or something has happened in your day which was just incredibly exciting, and you're just bubbling over and you're steaming, and you go running up to somebody, God, this greatest thing happened to me, and then you go on and the person goes, oh. You know, it just kind of takes the wind out of your sails. You know, it just kind of drops right there. Why did that happen? Maybe it's the case that the person you're talking to had probably one of the most wretched days of their life. Everything possibly that could have gone wrong went wrong that day, and they don't feel like smiling. They don't feel like being happy. They don't feel like sharing your joy. Okay? They don't have the same motivation. For the things that you want to get out and have them done right and have them done, you know, expertly, and you want them to be perfect and letter perfect and everything else,
the person who may be receiving that message may not have the same orientation as you do. Okay, and therefore, those things don't get done the same way. What I'm saying then is you have to understand the frame of reference, to use the term that we had this morning, that the other person is coming from. Where are they? What are they doing? What are they thinking? Another problem which is related to that has to do with just the physical processing capacities of our bodies. Right? Each day, at each moment, at any given moment, you're being bombarded by stimuli. Right? The lighting in the room, the hum of the air conditioner, the sound of my voice, the waving of my hands, the itch you have in your knee, the sweat that's rolling off your face, all of these things are bothering you. All of these things are impinging upon you. You can't, physically, cannot process all of it. It's impossible to do. You cannot attune to everything that is going on around you. Your body compensates for that. Your mind compensates for that. And what it does is it weeds things out. It says, I'm not going to pay attention to those things. I'm only going to pay attention to those things which I'm capable of processing. So you engage in what is called selective perception. You selectively perceive those things around you which you want to, which you're capable of doing, and you weed out all the other stuff. Okay, so there are some things that you don't attune to, which is why when you're walking with someone or talking with somebody, you say, hey, did you see that? And they say, no. Or why when you have five people who watch an accident, you get five different accounts. There's some other processes that happen, and we'll get to that in a minute. But you get the five different accounts because they did see five different things. Because they weren't all watching the same things. Not everything was as important. Okay? The second thing you do, which can complicate matters even more, is that you also engage in a process called selective retention. Which means that even all those things you end up processing and getting in, you don't remember all of them. Some of them are important, some of them are not important, and that's all up to you. I mean, you make that decision somewhere along the line, either consciously or unconsciously, and so you forget some things. Okay? The forgetting is really called something called leveling, and those things which you really focus in on and remember is called sharpening. And that can happen in a message, in an event, whatever happens to be going on. As I speak to you when you leave here today, some of the things that I've talked about, you'll level out. You'll forget about them. I may hit a word that's important to you, and therefore you'll focus in on it, and that'll be sharpening. The third thing that happens in that process is a term called assimilation, and that one's probably the most interesting and the most confusing. It's called filling in the gaps. Those things which you don't really remember, but you fill them in their logical sequence. In other words, there's a gray area there. You remember this happened, you remember this happened, but there's a space in between. In order to fill in the space in between, you figure out what logically had to transfer from point A to point B. And where does that logic come from? Your past experience. Now, each person's past experience is different. Bless you. Each person's past experience is different, and therefore that gap that you fill in is going to be different. It becomes logical. And it's logical to you. So it's something that you really didn't see happen, really don't remember, but it logically had to be there and it comes out of your own past experience. It's a form of distortion. Okay? Now what happens if you can process all that together, send a message to somebody. Send a message that has to be rooted. Do it verbally. It's like the game of telephone we all played when we were little kids. You whisper the message to the person next to you. That person, first of all, selectively perceives, selectively retains, sharpens, levels, assimilates, passes it on to the next person. The message is no longer the same as when it first started. That second person passes it on. All right? It's now, you have to understand, one step removed, and the person they give it to selectively perceives, selectively retains, sharpens, levels, and assimilates, and passes it on to the next person. Which is why when you go through 15 people, the message is humorous because it isn't anything like it first started out to be. And a lot of things that were based on your past experiences are built into that. Right? So in order to break down on the rumor clinic, you have to be able to understand where it is these people are coming from. Right? Understanding that people are not always fixating on the same things as you are. Right? Another interesting story, since we're supposed to, you know, we're told when we give speeches, we have to add humor. A friend of mine, who is no longer teaching there, but he was teaching at a junior college in Peoria, Illinois. And, I mean, who would want to teach at a junior college in Peoria, Illinois? But anyway, he was there, and they were doing some construction on campus, and while they were doing some construction, remodeling buildings and putting in plumbing and all that kind of stuff, they built these Quonset huts. One of the Quonset huts happened to be the men's restroom. Okay, well, one day this professor friend of mine was in the men's restroom, and the student worker had walked in who was cutting high grass with a sickle, and he had stuck the sickle in his back pocket and proceeded up to the urinal. Typical thing you would do in a men's restroom. Well, lo and behold, shortly thereafter, like just a few moments, the president of the university walked in. Okay. Even presidents of the universities have to go to the bathroom occasionally. But even he walked in and he went up to the urinal. Being in a strange surrounding, he was just kind of looking around at this Quonset hut. And the most terrible thing in the world happened. Now, for the women in the audience, the men I don't have to address this to because they understand this. They've noticed this, they were yay high. But for the women, let me give you a clue. There are norms that you follow in a men's restroom. The norms go something like this. When you're in a men's restroom, number one, never look at anybody else in the restroom. Don't talk to them either. Almost like an elevator. Except you do different things. But never look at anybody in the restroom. You can look up and read the graffiti. You can look down at yourself. But don't ever look at anybody else in the restroom. Well, the terrible thing that happened was that the norm was violated. In kind of looking around in the restroom, his eyes met with a student worker. And he got very nervous. I mean, you get nervous when you violate norms. You get nervous when you do something you're not supposed to do. So the president of the university felt compelled to say something. And looking over at the student, he noticed the sickle in his back pocket. And he says, "My." He goes, "That's quite a weapon you got there." And the student smiled and said, "Thank you." Okay, again, coming from two different places, they obviously weren't fixating on the same things. Was the president embarrassed at that point? Well, you better believe it. Okay. Was there an error in communication? Depends on which side you're looking at. But the attention span is different, which is why a lot of times somebody will say something to you and you'll even respond to it, but you never really heard it. Or you'll respond to it and you'll go off and do exactly what you were told not to do because you processed some of it out. You were attending really to something else. All right. The realities are not the same. So what you have to do, what I'm saying throughout this whole thing, if you think about the three assumptions that are there, what I'm basically telling you that you have to do is to take a receiver orientation. Understand where the other person is coming from. All right? How do you get that information? What is it that you can do? Well, the first thing that you should do is get feedback. It's as simple as that. And it sounds really easy. So, well, of course, how obvious. How often do you do that? I would assert not very. I mean, I've been teaching this stuff for the last 7 years, and I still don't do it all the time. I have to keep reminding myself that that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And why? Because it takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of time, and there's some other problems that arise when you do that, which we'll get to in a minute. But ask for feedback. The more you ask the other person and try to understand what their frame of reference is to coming back, the better off you know how to tailor your message. If you remember that the first thing that you want to do is to be able to affect that other person's behavior, and to be able to deal with that other person, then you have to know where that person is coming from. All right? In order to be able to do that, obviously these three assumptions are very related, because the second one, if you remember what I said, was that you have to understand the meanings that they have for the words you're about to use. And how do you get the meanings that they have? You ask them. You ask them what it is they mean, and let them respond to it. How do you understand what the person's reality is? Ask them. Just ask them. And the other way you can get effective communication is not only from the sender's point of view, but think of it as the term of the receiver. And think of it as far as the terms with, and this applies to whether you're dealing with clients, whether you're dealing with friends, whether you're dealing with spouses, no matter who it is. Take the role of the receiver. All right? If you don't really think you understand something, or you're really not sure if you understand something, ask the sender what they meant. I mean, the responsibility is twofold. It's on both sides. You have to ask what it is they meant. How many times do we have people, and this has happened to me so many times, I get sick of it, you know, and then you have to go back, and that's embarrassing. All right? But you have somebody in who, I used to work on a grant that was studying videotape in the legal environment. We were sitting down and having a meeting one day, and we were talking about our plan of attack for the next study. Excuse me, and it was a very hot day, and it was kind of, you know, I was kind of sweating, my mind was kind of drifting, and I had a couple other things in my mind, and I wasn't really paying all that close attention to what was going on. And so we got to the point where the magic words hit, which was, "Do you understand?" And the response, of course, is one which we always say, "Yeah." All right? Praying to God that the person sitting next to you has processed all of it. Okay? So you walk out of the room when it's all done and everybody's happy, and you say, "God, what did he say?" He says, "Hell, I don't know. I was hoping you paid attention, you know." Where are you? You're back at square one. What are you going to do? You don't know what to do. All right? You have two courses of action that you can take at that point. One is just go ahead and do it and pray it's the right thing. The second thing is to go back and say, "Well, I really didn't understand what you were saying. Can you go over it again?" All right? Odds are, because you've now done it after the fact, that the person who told you is going to become very angry with you. But they will sit down and explain it again, step by step. And this time, you'd better get it right. You go back the third time you've had it. But the time to do that, the time to be able to ask questions to say that you don't understand is when you're in that initial meeting. When you're dealing with the person right there, that's the time that you have to ask on what it is that they really meant. And make sure you understand. All right, how do you make sure the other person understands? You engage in probably a phrase that you have all heard of before. It's called paraphrasing. Paraphrase what it is that the person has said. Put it into your own words. All right, I have kind of a bias against the vernacular, which became very popular sometime in the late 60s, early 70s, which was when everybody was supposed to be very open and honest with each other and say, well, what I hear you saying is, and I see what you mean is, and that kind of stuff. But while it was a little hokey and faddish at the time, it really makes a lot of sense. All right, if you want to get away from the hokiness of it, just say something like, is what you mean this, and then just turn it around and use your own words. Then the person has some understanding where it is that you're coming from. And they can say, yeah, that's exactly what I mean, or no, that's a little off base, but let me try to put it a different way. All right, so they then change the words, which then hopefully will change and have a different kind of meaning for you, and hopefully get the response that you want either way. Okay, those are the three basic assumptions. I think I did my job well. I talked very fast. I can go into a series of more. You want more? Do you have any questions? I'm not giving a tougher lecture tonight. So. No real problems.
Could you go back to since you asked for it, go back over the third point again, basically in very few words. What was the third point?
Oh, the objective reality?
Objective reality.
Yeah, the fact that there is no objective reality. Okay. The assumption, the erroneous assumption is that there is an objective reality. And the correct assumption is that it's not. It's subjective. Okay. Every person's reality is a little bit different. Because your reality that you carry around with you and the way you perceive things is primarily based on the way you were brought up. Now, they can be similar. Don't misunderstand me. I mean, if everybody's reality was so unique, then communication would be impossible. You couldn't talk to anybody. I mean, there's an overlap of grade that exists for each person just so we can communicate with each other. The biggest thing that it has to do with communication is that it impinges on some things that it says a number of points. One is that when you talk or when you send a message, it may not be processed in the way that you intended it to be, because they may pick out various things and not pick out various things. And the other thing is you understand that your receiver doesn't have the same motivation as you do when you give the message. They're coming from a different motivational state, 9 times out of 10. Okay, so you have to make sure that you choose your words carefully, but not because the words are appropriate in and of themselves, but because you want to be able to evoke a certain kind of meaning and understanding out of your receiver from where they're coming from. Does that make it any clearer? Okay. Yes?
When you talk about what you're talking about, I get the impression that you're doing it on a one-to-one basis. However, many of us deal with public that we may not see when we send out our messages. How do we know that we're making, well, of course, we know that they do it and not do it. And do it.
Yeah.
But when they give us feedback, how do we know that that is representative of our public? And how do we know that, I guess, all of us, how do you apply this to the public?
Excuse me. That's a very good question. The answer to that is not going to be as definitive as you'd like it to be, because I'm going to be able to tell you what you already know is that you can't be that precise when you're dealing with more than one person or with masses. Okay? And the larger the group, the more of a problem you have. What you do is you engage in a simple process called stereotyping. Now, that's a negative word, and I know that none of you like that. But let's talk about stereotyping for a minute since you brought it up. Stereotyping is something that we do constantly, day in and day out. Right? Why do we stereotype? For one of the reasons that we talked about as far as the objective reality assumption. You can't process that much information. Also, if you consider the first assumption that I said that was the correct one, is that you are wanting to affect the behavior of others, you have two options. One is to know everything that you could possibly know about every individual you will ever come in contact with. Let's face it, that's not going to happen. The other one is to stereotype. Okay? Stereotyping is okay to a point. And I'll tell you which point in a minute. Okay? The stereotyping, if you think about it, one of the things that you want to be able to do to communicate with somebody, if you accept the assumption that you're communicating to affect someone else's behavior. What you're basically saying that you want to do, which is another nasty phrase, is control your environment. Okay? I don't mean to say that you all are just a bunch of manipulative SOBs who are running around the world trying to control everybody else's behavior, but in a sense you are. Okay? If you think about it, no, controlling your environment, not a bunch of manipulative SOBs. If you think about it, think of how you feel when you get into a situation where you don't know how to act. Right? You don't know what to do. Right? You get very anxious, you get very nervous, you get very shaky, you don't know how to deal with yourself. You start looking around to see what other people are doing, and you mimic. Okay? But that gives you some clues. Right? But it's an uncomfortable situation. You like to be in control. You like to be able to know what's going to happen next. Right? The only way you can know what it is that's going to happen next is you have to collect some data. Right? I don't mean you have to go out and pass questionnaires out to people. Let's just do it commonsensically. All right? You make assessments of people. You collect data from them. What do they look like? Well, Kaminsky's got, you know, relatively long hair and a beard, but he's wearing a suit. A little contradictory. But that's okay. You, as soon as I walked up to this podium, are one of those mine? As soon as I walked up to this podium, each of you made an initial judgment. Right? As I started speaking, that judgment may have changed a little bit because now you have voice qualities to attach to it. Knowing that I am a professor at the University of New Mexico, you've made some other judgments. Okay? What you're doing is stereotyping, if you will, by the fact that, if you will, from even basic cultural data, you know that I am probably a white American middle-class male. That gives you some information about me. Knowing that I am a college professor at least gives you one of the groups that I belong to, so that gives you some more information about me. What you will do is start projecting and tailoring your message to what you think the average white American male who is a college professor who teaches in New Mexico, who might be from the Midwest, is probably going to think like this. That's tailored even a bit more by a white American male who teaches as a college professor at the University of New Mexico, who happens to have a beard and fairly long hair and a blue denim suit. All right, that changes the message a little bit more. If I was wearing a three-piece gray suit, had basic short hair, no beard, very thick bottle cap glasses, kind of hair kind of parted in the middle and pasted, and carried around a little book and kind of talked with a twang, you'd make a different set of assumptions about me. Your messages to me would be very, very different. Okay, so what I'm saying is, when you're dealing with the masses, as long as you don't know the group, what you have to do is stereotype. And what you're trying to do is hit the average of that audience. Now, granted, what's going to happen to it when I say it's non-precise, there are obviously going to be people who are going to deviate from that. You know, they can be a member or tell you that, you know, on an application form that says, I am a Roman Catholic. When was the last time you went to church? 1933. All right. When was the last time you ever used the word religion? Since I was two. All right. If you start tailoring messages to devout Roman Catholics, you're going to miss your mark slightly. They may understand what you're saying, but they're really not going to process it the same way. Okay? So obviously there are deviants. And obviously you're not going to be able to hit the entire group. But your best shot, because you have nothing else to go on, is to try to hit the average of the mass. The problem with stereotyping. The problem with stereotyping is when you fixate on that stage. When you say that the stereotype is the data for the individual and they are all like that. And what you're doing at that point is you are not processing what we call psychological data, which basically means that you're asking yourself the question, instead of when you're stereotyping, you're asking yourself the question, how is this one person similar to those groups of people? How are they the same? Okay, you're doing a thing called, if you want to get fancy about it, we'll get difficult early in the morning instead of late at night, stimulus generalization. All right? You're generalizing the person to a group. You're generalizing the person to a social class. You're generalizing the person to how you think those people should act. Okay? And on an initial basis, you have nothing else to go on. It's worth a stab in the dark. Okay? If you fixate at that stage, you're going to get into a lot of trouble. Because you have to, somewhere along the line, engage in a process called stimulus discrimination, which basically says all you're really trying to do is ask yourself the question, all right, I now know this person or these group of people have these characteristics. How are they different? How are they different from the group? Where do they deviate? Where do they violate my expectations? Now you're getting more precise data on how to deal with people on more of an individual basis, if you will. And you may even find out how a particular group of Shriners, if you will, deviate from your conception of Shriners as a whole. All right? If you want to know, go ask them. They're down the hall. There's a collection of clowns downstairs. All right? How do those clowns differ from the normal group of clowns? Well, you know, go and ask them. Watch them for a while. All right? Collect the data. You have to first figure out, if I told you that you were going to go down and have lunch with a group of clowns, you'd have a certain expectation of how they're supposed to react. All right? There's the stereotype. That's where it takes place. Now you have to find out how they're different and deal with them on that response. Okay? All right. Obviously, a lot of stereotypes, too, since I got into it, are going to be erroneous. And if you have an erroneous stereotype, then you got a lot of problems. Then you're not only going to not hit the average, you're going to miss the mark completely. So I would even question, you know, you have to be able to make sure that you have accurate stereotypical data for the average kind of person. And that'll hit in okay. Does that help? Okay. Yes?
Your second assumption and also the third about words don't have their own meaning except people.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning for people and there's no effect on the others. When you're dealing with a large group of people,
I know what your reality is.
People, then, don't you have to be super careful? And then those assumptions, which are on one basis erroneous, become a little bit more correct. I.e., there's, well, for an example, actually, you've got ecstatic and happy. I'm happy. I'm ecstatic. Two entirely different emotional levels. How much that emotion is. Depends on each one. But then you go more for the, don't you tend to want to go more for the word in those cases to kind of help you through it?
Yeah, one of the things that I tried to get at when I was talking about, even when somebody said if you have that many objective realities or subjective realities, you know, how do you mesh them? Right? There are meanings, if we go back to the stereotype, right? Given a given culture and given a given group, right? There are words that you can use which will, if the stereotype works right, will evoke a certain meaning from that group. Right? An example, let's take a word like freedom. Let's go to the John Birch Society for one group and use the word freedom. Let's go to the American Nazi Party and use the word freedom. Right? Now, if you think about the stereotype of whatever you have for the John Birch Society or the American Nazis, you know, movement, if you use the word freedom, you could probably, with some degree of accuracy, predict the kind of response you're going to get. Or at least be able to predict how they're going to process that word of freedom. Okay? And what I'm saying is, I don't want to make people paranoid about what they say to groups of people. Because there are words that you can use in the English language which have a shared meaning. It may not carry the same intensity. You may be able to flip off to different reference if you want, and be able to think of different things, you know, that's in your reality you can apply the word clowns to, if you will. Right, you can think of circus performer, you can think of administrators, you can think of your boss, you can think of your wife, you can think of, you know, I mean, yeah, you can think of the word clown and say, well, you know, clown can mean a lot of things. Okay? What I might want to be able to do if I'm going to be using a word that I think is going to be somewhat vague, I may want to throw in an example to pinpoint what it is that I'm saying. Right? But the best thing I can do, even with a group of people, if you have the chance, now a lot of times it could be a one-shot message that you're giving to a mass, you know, ask them what they mean by clowns. You know, when I say the word clown, what do you think of? You told me administrators. All right. I know whenever I want to talk about administrators, do you all have to do is say clowns? Okay, but that's neither here nor there. but the shared meaning aspect of it is the one that you can usually base it by saying that this word will have intuitively a probability of bringing about the response that I want, and stay away from words that have high degrees of intensity unless you're trying to get an emotional rise out of people. You know, and just try to use words that you think that people will have a general understanding for. Right? Again, the important point, you know, dealing with masses as opposed to one-to-one, is that the word that you use is going to have, if you will, a connotative meaning attached to it from each individual, which may change the intensity of that. Okay, and there's no way you can control it. It depends on, you know, what side of the bed the person got out of that morning. Right? But odds are they may still understand what it is you're saying. Which is why, you know, in even giving this talk, I could probably say, unless I've really blown it, you know, a couple of people are going to come up and say, God, that was really exciting. I really enjoyed what you say. I learned a lot. And there's a couple of people are going to be sitting there going, oh, yeah. All right? Because it's a different frame of reference. They don't really, you know, things turn people on, things turn people off. Does that make any sense in clear enough? Yeah.
on the bucket approach, when you see this happening and someone comes to you and says, I told them exactly how to do it, and they didn't follow through.
You want me to do, what do you want me to do with it?
What would you respond to the person?
Make sure they understand what you said. I mean, yeah, you told them. You're the onlooker in the situation? Basically, all you can really point out is that, yeah, you told them what it was that you understood. But of course, you understood it because you thought of it. You understood it because it was your idea. You understood it because you had all the motivation behind you to do that. Right? They didn't do it because they didn't understand you. And what do people do when they don't understand you? Well, think about the reason why you don't ask for feedback. All right? Is because you don't want to appear stupid. I don't want to ask a question. If I ask a question, I'm going to come off like a real dummy. And if I come off like a real dummy, this guy's going to think I'm a jerk, so I'm not going to ask him questions. I'm going to say, yeah, I understand. And then you go and do something and really look like a dummy. Okay? Or don't do it. The thing to do is ask. What I would do for that person is they didn't do it. It's, to me, it becomes obvious at that point that two things had happened. Either they didn't understand what it was that was said, or they're irresponsible. Okay? Now, the irresponsibility aspect of it can be figured out fairly quickly. All right. How many times has that happened with that person? You know, how often are they responsible? Do they do everything, whether or not you give them a message or not? Are they fairly competent and careful about the work they do? You know, or do they blow everything off? All right. If that's the case, then you need to talk to them a little bit about responsibility. Assuming that's not the case, which 9 times out of 10 it isn't, all right, then it's just a problem of understanding. In which case, what you do is tell the person, the next time, don't just go and give them a message. Ask them to translate it for you. Okay. If you go up to somebody and you say, listen, here's what I want you to do, do you understand? What's the response you're going to get? Yes. May they understand or may they not understand? Well, yeah, they may or may not. It's hard to say. They may be able to pull it off exactly the way you wanted them to, or they may not. So don't ask them, do you understand? If you're really concerned about it and it's really important, ask them to tell you what it is they're about to do. Ask them to rephrase what it is you just said. Ask them to summarize it. Ask them to paraphrase it. All right? It's going to appear the first couple times you do it, it's going to be awkward as hell. Because you're not accustomed to doing it. You're not accustomed to asking people to paraphrase what you just said and give it back to you. All right? But after you get into a routine of doing it, you know, a couple things will happen. One is that you'll begin to find out where it is your messages are failing. And the second thing is that once you begin to understand how that person is processing your message or how those people are processing your messages, you can retailer the words that you're using such that it will evoke that meaning, and you won't have to ask them to paraphrase as much. You may on important points. Does that make sense? Anything else? You all understood?
Yeah.
We'll see.